What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Marius, Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
Swangles and Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Iconic, YouTube, or Rockfin, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, we certainly do appreciate your support. We know that you have a million options out there, and we couldn't do this show without the amazing support of our sponsor, My Patriot Supply. They are so nice that they created their own website for us. It's called preparewithmacroaggressions.com, and you can go through that site and shop like normal at the store. And if 2020 taught us anything, it's that you better be prepared, not just for coronavirus situations, but for supply chain breakdowns. So they have emergency survival food. They have survival items. They have water filtration. They have air purification. They even have sprouting seeds. So do yourself a favor. At the very least, just go check them out. Go to preparewithmacroaggressions.com and help to support our show and support our sponsor as well. Well, this is going to be a fun episode for me, a really important episode for me, because we have Dennis McKenna on, and I've got to say, first of all, welcome to the show, Dennis. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thank you for inviting me, Charlie.
Well, thank you. Thank you for coming. And where this came out of is you are going to help me by default, convince my mother that I'm not insane.
And you're gonna be a tall order.
I know it might be a tall order, but when I was a freshman in college, I went to USC. My freshman year was fall of 1990. I had, as people do, my first psychedelic experience with psilocybin mushrooms, and it changed my life. I had heard of mushrooms. I knew a little bit about it. To be fair, I probably should have done more research before I did it, but I didn't. And anyway, it was fun for sure, but it was beyond that. It shattered. It opened me up to the possibility that everything that we know is wrong, as a famous ethnobotanist once said. So
right.
I have a very close relationship with my mother. And after this experience, a couple of days later, I called her and I told her, I said, I have done something that has changed my life. And I tried to explain how it worked, which is impossible. I tried to explain what I was feeling and how I was seeing things, and the feeling I had, not just that night, but in the days afterwards. And and I was trying to explain that there was a benefit in this, but yet I was talking about taking an illegal drug. And so to have a conversation with somebody about the benefit of this illegal drug, which, you know, as an 18-year-old, I don't know the ins and outs of why it's illegal. I just know that the police say you can't have it and therefore it's illegal. And so to have this conversation with my mother, who's very, you know, she's cool, but she's not that cool. She's not, right. She's not saying go do mushrooms. You'll like it. It wasn't until maybe, God, I don't know, 20 years later, maybe 20, a couple, you know, maybe 25 years later, that mm-hmm. I started to see these scientific studies that mm-hmm. were showing, I don't know if they were PET scans or CAT scans or whatever they were, of the brain before and then after a psilocybin mushroom session. And it was showing neural pathways connectivity. And I'm saying to my mom, look, this isn't just stoner talk. This isn't just, you know, your freshman son in college experimenting with drugs. There's something to this. Can you explain is there something to this? Is it connecting pathways? And if so, how does it, do we know how it works?
You're asking me this or your mother this? You're asking me.
I'm asking you this.
okay. Well, yes, there's definitely something to it. You know, I think the science supports that very well. But the problem you're up against, the reason I said it would be such a tall order, I was reflecting how it would be or how it was back in the past when I tried to explain the same thing to my mother and father, you know, and it was years earlier. It was around the end of the 60s. My father was having none of it. You know, I mean, this, it's all garbage. You're going to wreck your mind. This is, you know, I don't want to hear about it. You know, you're a bad son. You're horrible. You know, that you would even get into this. My mother was a little more open-minded, but still completely, you know, ignorant. I mean, she wanted to think the best of Terrence and me. She didn't want to dismiss us as completely crazy hippies who have decided to, you know, go down the path to perdition, although I'm sure that's what she thought. But she was a little more open-minded, even to the point where we finally persuaded her, it took some years, but we persuaded her to smoke a little hash. Mm-hmm. You know, and that was as far as it got. And she actually enjoyed that, but she was so guilty about enjoying it and so guilty about what her husband, my father, would think that, you know, it became like this forbidden thing, you know. Right. But I think the point is, and part of the larger point I'm making, one of the things about the psychedelic experience that makes it so hard to talk to people that have never had one is that, you know, there are two kinds of people in the world, those who have had a psychedelic experience and those who haven't. And there's only one way to convince those people of the value of a psychedelic experience, ultimately only one way, and that's to bring them into our camp. You have to convince them. Because everyone's psychedelic experience is unique to themselves. And yet you cannot really understand what people are talking about until you've had that experience. And then you can begin a conversation. You know, it's like, well, they may not even, you know, they don't have to be convinced that it's a good thing. Maybe they have a horrible trip. But they have to have the trip. Otherwise, you're talking, you know, donuts to oranges or something. Yeah. You're just not on the same page. And so it's different. This has always been the problem with the conversation about drugs, because the people that are adamant against it, to be honest, don't know what the fuck they're talking about.
Right.
You know, because they've never taken it. And so my, you know, what I've come down to over the years and, you know, in that situation, it's like, well, we really can't even have a conversation about this that's meaningful.
Yeah.
You know, when you take a psychedelic and integrate that experience, give me a buzz and then we'll talk. You know, it's kind of like that, because there's no point in talking unless they've shared the experience.
Well, it's funny you say that, because one of the quotes that I used in my first book, The Octopus of Global Control, I brought in all of these quotes from a variety of people, over 500 different people. And Terrence was in there quite a bit. And I have to read you a quote from his, because what he said, what I put in the book, that's so, it's so in line with what you're saying. He said, DMT is a reliable method for crossing into a dimension that human beings have debated the existence of for 50,000 years. Is there an invisible nearby world inhabited by active intelligences with which human beings can communicate? You bet. And if you don't think so, tell me you don't think so after you've smoked 75 milligrams of DMT. Otherwise, we just don't have anything to talk about.
That's exactly right. There is nothing to discuss until you've put that on your map. And then after you do that, there's plenty to discuss.
Oh yeah.
But it won't be the conversation you thought we'd have. You know, it's going to be the conversation about what is this, not about whether to do it or does it have value. All that just goes away, and then you can talk about, well, what does this really mean, if anything, and what does it mean that we as human beings, you know, have apparently the neural architecture to have these kinds of experiences, you know, and what does that mean to us as individuals and collectively to the species and so on. I mean, everybody, or many people write to me, and the first thing they write or say is, psilocybin changed my life, or psilocybin saved my life. That's a pretty bold claim. And yet we know it's true because we've had, we've had these experiences and they have impacted our life. But, you know, I mean, I sometimes say, talking about this, you know, it does not take, I mean, people say, well, you know, you need to have faith, right? I say faith is an impediment in this case. Faith is an obstacle. You don't need faith because the experience itself will convince you. So there's nothing to have faith about. What is required is courage. Mm-hmm. More than faith, and the rejection of faith in a way. It's like, oh, okay, you can approach it. I'm a hard-bound reductionist materialist. I have no, you know, faith that these experiences will have any value. But, you know, you sit down, you take the pipe or you drink the cup, and that pretty much rearranges your perspectives. And that's the point. These things are transformative, and usually in a good way. And that is that's the value of them therapeutically, I think, as well as just as tools for expanding consciousness. You know, they let you step out of your reference frame, and that's a really valuable thing, because most people are quite invested in their reference frame, you know, everybody is, yeah. But I know enough to, you know, those of us who are psychedelic or have that experience know that it's very valuable to demolish that reference frame once in a while,
yeah.
You know, and then you open yourself to learning new things that would otherwise never get through those filters, right? You're confronted with the usual, my mind is made up. Don't confuse me with facts. You know,
right.
I don't want to hear about it. Yeah. And that's the attitude you come up against. So these things are tremendous, tremendously valuable for reminding us how little we know. You know, the limitations of our knowledge. And this is, people ask me a lot, okay, you've been taking psychedelics for 60 or 70 years. Well, not 70 years, I am 70. So let's say 50 years, a good 50 years that I've been involved in this thing. And they say, so what have you learned? What are the main lessons that you've learned from all this? And I have to say, you're going to be disappointed, because the lessons that I've learned is that I don't know anything.
Exactly.
You know, I get this again and again from ayahuasca or mushrooms or whatever. In other words, don't be arrogant about what you think you know, because you don't know shit.
Right.
Just Is this a family podcast? Could I use those words?
It's encouraged, frankly.
Okay.
Yeah. The ego dissolution, you know, you spend your whole life, if you're in a good family, having your parents build up your self-esteem and build up your ego and help you feel, you know, and then you go into the psychedelic world and it dissolves your ego. Right away, you go, who am I? I know who I am in the waking world, but if I can't anchor myself to any of those things because they've dissolved in front of my eyes in the psychedelic world, well, who am I? And the answer is, who have you ever been? You're the same person you've ever been, or are you? You know,
right.
And is it a case though that now the science is finally catching up with the mystique of something like psilocybin, where we've been talking about it's got benefits. There's benefits to the brain. We're talking about we feel better, we're interacting better, but hard to quantify that until recently with these studies that have been showing that the use of psilocybin reconnects these neural pathways. And I think to myself, well, finally, I'm not crazy. You know, finally I can point to this study and say, well, I mean, I'm not saying that this study says everything, but it says something. I mean, it says that there's something happening in your brain that's very positive after that effect. And it's impossible for me as a, you know, an 18-year-old kid in college to quantify that or even explain it, even if I could. And yet here I am now in my late 40s and I'm going, see, I'm still having this conversation with my mom still. I'm saying, see, I'm telling you, there's benefit here. And the demonization of it seems like it put a real, did a real, real good job of just throwing up a barrier and I don't know, a large segment of the population just went, oh, it's illegal and you're not supposed to do it. And therefore they moved on to something else. And I would argue that is exactly what the state would like you to do. If they don't want you to do that, there's a reason. There must be, you know, as they say, it unpicks, you know, you.
Yeah. So you're one of those people. And I think psychedelic people tend to be these people. You question everything. You say, just because you tell me I'm not supposed to do it, that makes me all the more curious.
Yeah.
You know, what's so bad about this? What's so terrible that I should not go near this? And you know, and some things they tell you not to do that you probably shouldn't do, but psychedelics are not one of those things. Psychedelics are one of the things that Terrence like to say about psychedelics is, you know, they make you have funny ideas, you know, that's their value. They make you have funny ideas. Funny ideas are dangerous to the state, you know, to the people that want you to buy a particular party line that, you know, okay, I should work in a cubicle for some faceless corporation for the rest of my life so they can turn me out on the street when I'm 65, or I should go to Vietnam and kill people I've never seen. These sort of memes that the state and the corporate world puts out, it makes you question all that. You know, it makes you question all that. And for the person, that is a healthy thing, you know, to question those things, because you're finding your own ethical and moral perspective on things. And we should all strive for that. So many institutions, particularly religion and government and education, all of these things to a certain extent, but I would single out religion as being particularly noxious in this respect, in the sense that they're not interested in teaching you how to think for yourself.
Right.
They have a whole set of stuff that they want you to believe. And so the message is just accept this, have faith, and pretty much you'll be good and you can stop thinking. You don't have to trouble your pretty little brain about that anymore. That's settled, right?
Right.
And then, you know, you accept whatever the dogma or the teaching is and never have another thought, you know? And that's terrible. That's turning off the mind. Psychedelics are dangerous because they turn on the mind. They make you question. They make you see that things are much more marvelous than we can even imagine, and that our understanding of these things is, you know, we only understand a fraction of what is going on. you know, and I, you know, our knowledge is inherently quite limited, you know, even our scientific knowledge. And so psychedelics are good for making us astonished, at the same time sort of teaching us the lesson that, you know, you're never going to understand all of this stuff. That doesn't mean that you can't try. You know, I mean, that's part of the fun. Yeah, I know I'm never going to have all the final answers, but if you enjoy learning, if you enjoy thinking about stuff, then that's okay. Just knowing that, you know, you're never going to reach a point where you say, I've got it all figured out,
yeah.
You know, and there are many other people who will tell you they all have it figured out. You know, they have it all figured out.
Right.
I run away from those people because they clearly are deluded. They haven't really thought about this.
Well, the one of the quotes that I had in the book from your brother as well was, psychedelics are illegal, not because a loving government is concerned that you may jump out of a third story window. Psychedelics are illegal because they dissolve opinion structures and culturally laid down models of behavior and information processing. They open you up to the possibility that everything you know is wrong.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I mean, yeah, very, very eloquently put and more elaborately, but it's effectively the same.
Yeah.
The same realization, you know, the realization that we don't know shit.
Right.
You know, this is the thing, which I do, you know, some people would be depressed by that, but I'm actually excited by that because it means there's an infinite amount of things left to learn, left to understand, layers and layers of complexity and beauty and all of that is just built into reality, and we're only going to apprehend a tiny amount of it. And the same is true of science. You know, I mean, science can be a little arrogant itself. You know, we can really puff ourselves up about how much science has figured out, and, you know, and it has been impressive. There's no doubt that we've accumulated a great deal of knowledge through the scientific method. You know, but then along comes psychedelics, and you try to fit that into the scientific mold, and you realize again the limitations of science, yeah. You know, to the understanding. The difference being that, you know, I think a lot of scientists who work in the field of psychedelics, you know, they understand that science is basically an inadequate instrument for really probing this stuff, assuming that they have had psychedelic experiences. Right. And I know you're not supposed, you know, if you're a professional scientific researcher, you're not supposed to admit that. I mean, I long ago got outed, so it's okay for me. Yes, I have taken these things. I'm not right. denying it. But I think science is a good foil to, you know, when you want to initiate a conversation with the uninitiated and the skeptical, like your mother, mm-hmm. you know, our society respects science. It's the new religion, you know, and like if the scientists say it, it must be valid. It must be true. We know better, you know, we know that knowledge is limited, but as a way of having the conversation, you can say, Mom, you know, look at this article in Scientific American or whatever. You don't want to hit them with the technical stuff, but with right. the, you know, science journalism side of it. And if they're open-minded at all, then they'll read it and maybe they'll say, well, maybe there is something here. You know, I mean, the difference would be my father back in the day, if I tried to get him to read something like this, it didn't exist in the day, but he would say, I just don't want to hear about it. I'm not going to read it. My mom, at least she would have read it. Right. Still not necessarily convinced, but at least not shutting the door on it entirely.
Well, what are you doing? I'm curious to know what you're doing, because you're with the McKenna Academy of Natural Philosophy. This seems like a kind of a natural evolution. Where what? Explain what it is exactly that you're doing there, and how and the role of psychedelics in your academy.
Okay, well, the academy, yeah, it's kind of a think tank. It's kind of it is a forum basically for inquiry into these different areas, and not just psychedelics, but kind of the whole, you know, I call it a 21st century mystery school, and it's founded in the spirit of the ancient mystery schools, of which Eleusis was probably the longest lasting and one of the most famous, in which it's clear that psychedelic experiences, whatever the medicine might have been, good case that it probably was ergot, although I'm not sure I totally believe with that, but it's pretty clear that they were taking a psychoactive beverage, and that people made this pilgrimage to Eleusis to have this profound, ineffable experience. It was just something that you did if you were a member of Greek society or later even Roman society. It was something that you did, and it was expected. It was expected and respected. It were expected to do it, and having this experience was an initiatory. It served an initiatory function, again, putting those people who had never had the experience into the camp of those who had. So the McKenna Academy is the same kind of thing. It's a forum for the exploration of ideas. It is not about plant medicines exclusively, but learning about and experiencing from plant medicines is an important element of what it wants to do. In the same way, these are tools for learning, basically, and the academy is all about learning. And I sometimes say, it's hopefully it's in the spirit of Eleusis, and contemporaneously, it is. In the spirit of Esalen or Hollyhock or these places that are like places you go to be edified and have your mind open and talk about really cool stuff, and bring brilliant minds together. But I sometimes say it'll be the first psychedelic university in 1600 years and the first university where not all the faculty are human.
Ooh, interesting.
So that's kind of what it is.
How do you get around the laws? Is this a religious ceremony? Is this an education? How does that all work?
Well, we're not doing anything. Well, here's how we get around it. When we originally set up the academy, the idea was that we would do retreats and conferences in other countries like South America, right, which is what we have been doing for a while before there was an academy. I've basically been organizing ayahuasca retreats since 2012 down in Peru on a regular basis. And then even before that, I was on an irregular basis organizing these conferences and retreats. And that was part of the original plan. Well, COVID had other plans, and COVID has shut down all that. We're not doing any of that anymore. We're just waiting for things to open up, and we intend to do that. In the meantime, we've had to go virtual like everybody else and their dog. So we're trying to develop a strong online presence for the academy. And we've done a couple of, we've started this podcast series. We've done a couple of virtual symposia in the last year. And we're just going to keep on doing that and trying to put into, in front of people, topics that inspire them and interest them and deliver good information. So its function has sort of evolved by necessity to be more about teaching than actually creating experiences for people. That will come, and that's definitely a big part of the mission, is to create a place where people can come and they can have these experiences and it will transform their lives. But that said, also a big a very important principle for the Academy is we exist to help people learn how to think, mm-hmm. But not what to think. We definitely are not about dishing out a set of principles or dogma. That we're not a religion in that sense. In fact, we're an anti-religion, if anything, in that we emphasize people's God-given powers to think for themselves, to use these brains in creative ways. When you're dealing in a realm like this, where powerful spiritual technologies are being utilized, and whether it's psychedelics or yoga or other types of disciplines, it's a difficult place to be in, because anytime you have power, you have unscrupulous people that want to grab the power and use it to their own ends. So it takes a lot of clarity and wisdom to sit with that power, but not be seduced by it, recognize it, but don't try to put it into a box, because you can't. And the chances are the box you're constructing is not the appropriate box anyway. So I don't know. I'm off in the metaphors here, but I think you can hear what I'm saying.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in so much of, my first book that I wrote about, I tackled a variety of topics, and one of them was education. The education system is broken. It's broken by design. It's intentional. Mm-hmm. They don't want you to explore these areas. I mean, this is off limits to, according to their schooling system. So if there is an alternative to that, like you said, teaching somebody how to think, not what to think, one word changes everything in that sentence, but it will change your life. And that is unfortunately what we have been experiencing for the last, 100 years or so, at least in the United States. Call it brainwashing, calling it a curriculum, whatever, but it's teaching people what to think, what is to be believed, what isn't to be believed. And it's very limiting and you don't realize how limiting it is until you get out of it and have a psychedelic experience and you go, oh my God, why wasn't I aware of this? Why didn't I get the memo?
They didn't want you to know about it. I mean, that's the basic reason, but that's exactly right. It does not serve the purpose of the state of institutions to have active thinkers, to have curious minds that are asking a lot of pesky questions. Mm-hmm. You're just supposed to kind of accept what they tell you, and you're questioning it is not welcome. And we've seen in recent, over the last 4 years and the whole political situation, the consequences of that.
Yeah.
And you have a vast number of people who believe that Trump, didn't lose the election. And this just flies in the face of reality. I mean, I don't care what side of the political spectrum you're on. Well, I mean, I do, but I think I'm probably... But the point is that you have to respect facts. And there's been a whole meme a whole group of people that have decided we're not going to accept facts. We'll create our own alternate realities.
Yeah.
This is disturbing to me.
Well, but there's a lot of people that that have been told facts by the establishment and they go, those aren't facts.
Yeah, and they turn out not to be facts.
Yeah, so yes. they have very, you know, sort of and you know, different take on what is a fact and what isn't a fact. And one of the things that right. like when we talk about the government's role in this, it gets me back to, so I was speaking at Anarcapulco, which is the largest anarchist convention in Mexico. And one of the options they have is a little a la carte add on to your experience things. You can, they brought in this group of shaman that were phenomenal from, I think they were from Mexico. And you could sign up for the, ayahuasca session ceremony. Mm-hmm. And I did. And I had never done it before. But I had written in the book, a quote from Graham Hancock that described it, you know, the taste of it. It's like a raw sewage, a pile of dirty socks, battery acid, and just a hint of chocolate. And so as I'm drinking this and I'm drinking, I'm going, God damn it, Graham was right, you know. And so then I go home. I live in Denver. Denver is the first city to decriminalize mushrooms.
Right.
And I wind up in an event and I wind up running into Graham and I said to him, Graham, I wrote this book. I put this quote in there about the sock, the dirty socks and the battery acid and the hint of chocolate and everything. I said, I just got to tell you, you were so correct. And as I was drinking it, I was thinking it, and he just looks at me and he goes, oh, like he shuddered right. just thinking of the taste of it all. But I wondered about this with regard to the ayahuasca situation and then psilocybin mushrooms in Denver. We see the decriminalization starting, and then I think it spread to Santa Cruz.
It's happening in a number of different communities now, and at the state level in certain like Oregon and so on. So
yeah, that's what
I want. Definitely, this movement is spreading.
Yeah, where is it heading? Is it being? Is this an? Whenever I think of a movement, I in my head I think, well, there's got to be somebody in charge of it, right? Or if somebody has come to the forefront and has taken the reins on this. Is there a movement to decriminalize this, or is this just more of a decentralized feeling among everybody and no organized movement is necessarily needed?
I think it's more of a decentralized thing. I think because it's community-based, this is where it, you know, at the community level, there are leaders, there are organizers, but the nationwide and now global consensus that these plants, at least, and fungi should be decriminalized. I think that's a meme that is shared globally. And I think that the control, to the extent that you see it, is at the local level, local grassroots type organizing and so on. But that has an effect on the global level. Mm-hmm. You know, the thing about the decrim movement that bothers me a little bit, or did bother me, is I think that is healthy because that is a step toward reorienting our relationship with these natural psychedelics, reorienting them and acknowledging their value. But what it also is a reminder of the idea that these things were ever criminalized in the first place is absurd. The idea that we as a species have the, you know, this arrogant notion that we have a right to declare a plant or an animal or a fungus like it does not have the right to exist on this planet, that's incredibly arrogant and just wrong. This is the problem, you know, that is exemplified by this notion that we own nature and that nature exists to serve us. And that has been, you know, our minds have been poisoned into thinking this. This is the legacy of the Judeo-Christian tradition, which says, you know, dominate the earth, dominate nature. Because what that leads to is a devaluation of nature. And the same, you know, and fosters notions that, well, we don't have to worry about preserving the planet or protecting the planet because our reward is in heaven.
Right.
You know, I'm sorry, it's a shell game. I mean, maybe there's a heaven, maybe there's not, but I would rather put my effort toward making this planet a paradise,
yeah.
You know, and we can do it, but we have to realize a bunch of things. And this is what the McKenna Academy is also about a lot, is helping people wake up to the fact that we are so estranged from nature. We are so out of touch with nature. And as a consequence with our own natures, you know, which is part of nature. And it's a part that we've often walled off, you know? So the important, you know, the decrim movements are good, are a hopeful sign that we may get this thing right eventually. I mean, in some of my talks, I say the right to form symbioses with organisms should be stated as a fundamental right, you know, and not even a human right, a right of any living thing to form an alliance with any other living thing for mutual benefit and development. That's what symbiosis is. And anytime we identify a plant or a fungus or anything that provides something useful to us, you know, I mean, it may be a drug, maybe it's nutrition, maybe it's aesthetic value, all of the reasons that we value non-human organisms, that's a form of symbiosis, you know. And I think in the Charter of, you know, in the Charter of Rights, and I think I'm careful not to say just human rights, I think we should assert the right to form a symbiotic alliance with any damn thing we want, you know, as long as it does not hurt any other living thing, you know. And this idea of having a, you know, a return to the notion of symbiosis is an important element of our vision, our mission, and so on. Because symbiosis on the evolutionary level is, I think, a more fundamental process than competition, survival of the fittest, all of that. All of that goes on. But really what drives evolution is symbiosis, collaboration, you know, rising all species. And that's what drives evolution forward. And if you look at biology at whatever level, you see this is going on. You know, there are all kinds of symbioses that, well, it's hard to find a situation where there isn't one. You know, I mean, we have bacteria living inside of us. About 40% of our biomass is not human genetics. You know, plants have fungi living inside them. Fungi have viruses and bacteria living inside them. It's all together in this symbiotic party, I guess you could say. Yeah. You know, the enterprise of life on Earth is driven by symbiosis.
You can now, off of that, you can now understand why the government would want to break that up, because the idea of everybody working together makes them A, threatened, B, yeah, irrelevant, and yeah, C, a target. So,
yeah,
so if so, for them to come in and try and break up any sort of relationships that we're making, you know, with anything, that seems to be their MO over the years. But when did this start? Because we're living in this modern age world where mushrooms are illegal, ayahuasca is illegal in the United States, and all these things, or I guess in with the exception of certain reasons, but for the most part, okay, for the purpose of this conversation, illegal. When did that happen? Is that a because these obviously these plants have been around for forever, and they've been used by people for a long, long time. I mean, I think there's even stories in the Bible that people have said, well, this might be the acacia, the burning bush might be the acacia bush burning, and all these things. So we've clearly, there's documented history of people using these substances for a very, very long time. When did the government get nervous?
Oh, I think it happened long before that. I think it happened. I mean, I think it's always been true for, you know, Terrence talks about, we know that the expulsion of Adam and Eve out of paradise is a myth, right? But it's kind of at the center of the whole Christian idea. And Terrence just discussed this. This was nature's first drug bust. You know, really, I mean, look at it. You know, here are these people, they're consuming something that's obviously psychoactive, that's giving them knowledge that the big guy upstairs says you're not supposed to have. That's when it started. And these substances have always been esoteric and guarded and prohibited, because it's the eternal dynamic, eternal tension between those who have the power and want to keep it, and a lot of that has to do with guarding their knowledge, guarding their secrets. And the opposite tendency is the people that want to blow it all wide open and be free to have these experiences. You know, the war on drug, and Graham has famously said this many times, you know, the war on drugs is not a war on substances, it's a war on consciousness. You know, that's what it is. It's the war on consciousness. This is not about protecting us from harmful substances. It's not even clear, you know, that is the government's job. I mean, we tend to, but, you know, there were traditions of traditional medicine and shamanic knowledge and all this for 10,000 years before there was an FDA to tell you that this was prohibited. You know, so it's just the people, people in power want to preserve their power. And part of the reason is, part of the way they do that is to keep this knowledge and these technologies away from people. In other words, not trust people to trust themselves to figure it out. This comes back to, we don't really look at our citizens as fully empowered citizens. They're more like children, unruly children that have to be disciplined and have to be, you know, told what they can and can't do. Well, within limits, you know, I mean, with respect to substances, I just don't think this can apply. These things have always been bludgeons, basically, to beat people into line, to scare people into line, very often directed at particular ethnic groups. I mean, they've always been an instrument of racism, the suppression of people's access to substances or the persecution of them if they do use these substances. So it's just the same old power dynamic that's going on.
Yeah. Tell me about what were the retreats in Peru like? What's that? I know that you can't do them right now anymore, but I know that John Perkins, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, has been doing that for a long, long time. I know that there's quite an industry of doing that. Do you think you'll ever get to the point where we don't have to get on a plane and go to a foreign country in order to explore our consciousness? Or is this...
No, honestly, that's what I'm hoping for. That is really... And that's one of the things about the Dinkrim movements that really encourages me. That's what I'm hoping for. I have been organizing ayahuasca retreats for... Depends on when you start counting, but really since the mid-90s, off and on, and then since 2012 on a more regular basis. But I'm conflicted about that, because the ayahuasca tourism industry has both benefits and detriments when it comes to the indigenous communities that are the stewards of these medicines. Mm-hmm. A bunch of gringos with fat wallets and very little cultural respect coming down there to have ayahuasca can be a a dangerous, you know, a bad situation. And then the other side of that is that there's tremendous pressure now on these resources, on ayahuasca as a good example, or these other natural medicines. Mushrooms, not so much, because you can grow tons of mushrooms. You're not depleting a natural resource. But ayahuasca, you know, there's plenty of evidence that it's getting harder and harder to find the big vines, which are considered the source of the best ayahuasca. People have to go further and further into the jungle. So, and there's very little effort made to ensure sustainability. Some of the retreat centers and so on that do this, you know, feel that responsibility, and they do sponsor, you know, they fund cultivation and so on, so they don't have to deplete it from the jungle. But I think the decrim movement is very encouraging in that, what I would like to see is instead of taking the people to the medicine, instead of sending people down to South America, bring the medicine to North America, let it be administered in centers, which already exist, a lot of them, except that they're under the radar. Let those centers come out into the open and then bring the medicine there. Pay the indigenous people, you know, to produce it, and send their people up if they want. But in other words, reverse the equation. Bring the medicine to the people, to these centers that could, you know, many of them already exist. The problem is that they can't be public about it. But I look forward to the day where, when, if psychedelics is going to get integrated into our society, it will be through these community centers rather than through a biomedical model where you have to go to a clinic or a hospital. It's all under the control of doctors and clinicians. In some cases, that may be indicated. But in a lot of cases, I think that, you know, that the psychiatric healthcare that involves psychedelics is going to look more like shamanism than it is our conventional models. So we may as well start practicing that, you know, and I think it could do so much for people's individuals' mental health, but also for the community's mental health and for societies in general. If there were a place, a center at like every community where you could go for a weekend, they wouldn't look like clinics. They'd look like spas or something like that. You would go there, could do a little body work, maybe some nutritional counseling, maybe, you know, a little massage, some holistic therapies. And on the menu, if you choose, you can take a psychedelic in a safe environment, looked after by people that know what they're doing and are there to help you have a healing experience, a good experience. I think it would do so much to heal our society in that way, if that was just a resource. Because where do people find it now? You know, they turn to religion, and religion, and the centers I'm visualizing would not be pushing any particular religion. I mean, there are ayahuasca religions. Some of them are even, you know, are approved to work in the States. And, and, you know, these are good people. I mean, I know people in the UDV very well. And, you know, they're good people. I'm not going to join their church because I don't join churches. You know, I just don't accept it. I just like to be able to go to a community center where I could bring my family, you know, including, you know, adolescent children, and share these experiences. You know, one of the interesting things that I found, or that we discovered when we were doing these retreats in South America, we had a number of occasions where, you know, adults would come and they would bring their adolescent children, you know, generally not too young, but, you know, 16 to 18 or so, they'd bring their adolescent children. And for one thing, the fact that they could do that bespeaks a tremendous, you know, says much positive about the relationship of the parents and the children. But all parents and all children at some point have, you know, conflicts, and it's just a part of growing up. This can be so useful for family dynamics, I think, and really creating spaces where people can just open up to each other and honestly, and in a spirit of love and mutual respect, get it all out on the table, you know, yeah. And really resolve some of these things. So I think these community centers are the wave of the future, and it's you know, they won't be traditional like shamanic retreats. There may be shamans, there may not be, and it won't be like a, you know, it will be some kind of a hybrid thing, you know, where you may have psychotherapists on staff working alongside shamans, you know, and then people should also just be able to have, you know, their own experiences without necessarily buying into either bottle. If they just want to explore on their own, that also should be allowed and encouraged. You know, it's yeah. not necessarily that you have to have a guide for this. Usually in the early stages, it helps. But, you know, but I think that if psychedelics are actually going to have a sustained presence in our society and really move things forward, this is the model that's going to do that.
Well, nobody has done more for the psychedelic community than the McKenna brothers, for sure. And
I don't know.
I think you've made it safe to have the conversation about it. You've validated it in a sense, coming from the scientific world, and showing it is not just, this isn't a party drug. It's far right. from that. You think you're going right. to go do DMT at some party. You're mm-hmm. You're at the wrong party. But this is, this has been, you know, you've made it real because you guys are, you know, have real scientific backgrounds in this, and it took it out of the light of, you know, sort of stoner talk and made it more science talk. And when right. Rogan, or when Paul Stamets is on Rogan or whatever, you know, then it's, now you're talking about a national spotlight to this. And I'll end this with a quote mm-hmm. that I put in the book. And you mentioned part of this earlier. So when I wrote the first book, the Octopus book, it was, this comes from a chapter titled Death by Astonishment. And this is the quote, the we'll end with this quote from your brother. What happens on DMT is a troop of elves smashes down your front door and rotates and balances the wheels of the after death vehicle, the bill, then depart. It's completely paradigm shattering. I mean, union of the white light, you could handle an invasion of your apartment by jeweled self dribbling basketballs from hyperspace that are speaking in demotic Greek is not something you anticipated. And
that's something you counted on. That's right.
Sometimes people say, is DMT dangerous? It sounds so crazy. The answer is, only if you fear death by astonishment.
Yeah.
Dennis, thank you so much for being a part of this. Tell people where they can find you and find your work and support the McKenna Academy.
Okay. Well, that's easy. Just go to www.mckenna.academy and it'll all be there.
Perfect. Well, thank okay. you so much. And hey, everybody, if you liked this show, please share it. God knows the algorithms aren't going to help us out any. Thanks so much, Dennis, for being on the show.
This has been a wonderful conversation, Charlie. I really enjoyed it. Let me know when it's up there and I can get our peeps on it and we'll get it out to our social media. This has been a good talk.
I certainly will do that. And I appreciate you and I appreciate your willingness to jump on this call. Thanks.